Which one are you saying something scandalous about my college?
The whole movement
really started in a sort of way with a feeling about the need for social reform amongst the overburdened working class poor people who suffered. And also there was in it a factor of the women being misused by the men. There was a sort of picture of the rather brutal man who made his wife pregnant every year. So that was one side of it. But generally, Maurice Topes' husband, A.B. Rowe, had been wanting, because of his awareness of his workers, I think it was in Manchester where their works were, to open a birth control clinic. And he couldn't get anyone to do it for him. And when he married Maurice Topes, who had written this book about passionate love, which was not to do with birth control, he got her into it first. And they opened the first clinic with this idea of improving social conditions. That, you know, the poor out of ignorance and suffering, and that when they had these large families, on the other hand, they were so crippling. There were both sides of it. At the same time, Maurice Topes was involved with it, with the passionate experience of the woman which she put on the map, which hadn't been mentioned before. They'd been rather the sort of... It was something that...
The woman's right to sexual fulfillment.
Not right, but the fact that a woman would experience passionate feeling, and that was part of what it was all about. She wasn't. You see, the word right comes into it in a different sort of way.
Yes.
And so, this is how it all started. But then, of course, there was a great deal of feeling against birth control, particularly religious, the church and so on. But gradually, as time has gone on, it has become accepted. But then it has emerged as a different situation altogether. Every woman now accepts it. It's her right to have birth control. And as times have changed, it's no longer a question of whether you're married or not married. And in fact, it is assumed that a girl can have intercourse just like a man could, and this has been, of course, very largely to do with the coming of the pill. Although before the coming of the pill, there were many of us who were working in birth control who had enormous numbers of patients, both at clinics and privately, whom we taught with diaphragms and taught with greater care about cheese and so on, and there wasn't, but so that there was a lot of women who were having active sexual lives, married or unmarried, and did not worry about pregnancy. But then this method was a much more sophisticated method in a sense, and there were many people to whom, particularly, you find that if you work with people who are very, because times have changed very much in those days, that the women who came from poor homes, overcrowded homes, with very little lack of privacy, you see, they were the prudish people. It's one of the things I learned from my work. You would think that they would be exposed to too much knowledge, that they would be the ones who would be not prudish. But it was just the other way around. They were the ones who had the difficulties. You see, it's very funny, isn't it?
Why do you think that contrast is? Because, as you say, you think the opposite.
Yes. Well, it's a very complicated thing. It's to do a lot with... Well, you have to go into the psychological field. It's another research if you want to.
You mean if you're on top of other people, you keep apart from them, sort of thing?
Well, it's not quite on those lines, but early exposure to a great deal of privacy, which should be private, makes people much more fragile and much more prudish and much more unable to let anyone come near them, in a way. Mm. So that, you see, since the coming of the pill, things have become much more clinical and much less human in a way. In the days of the cap, every patient has to be examined now for the pill as well. Can I pour you out some coffee?
That's awfully kind of you, yes. Do carry on, it's still on.
But it's all become clinical, that is, that lots of girls who go to a clinic don't really begin to think, and this is also, I mean, I'm going to jump in all over the place,
but
medicine has again, in a sense, become dehumanized and much more a conveyor belt. She gets her checkup, she gets her breast examined, she has a smear done, she's instructed in how to take the pill. She has no idea about her own inside. She has no idea what's going on. And you find, I've worked, I've always, you see, had a different approach, and so often, you see, you get the indirect information that this is somebody who has problems.
Yes, thank you. No sugar, thank you.
And
no.
When you milk?
Thank you, yes.
And right. When you ask them, they'll say, oh yes, you know, intercourse is always painful or whatever, and then you say, why didn't you tell me? Well, they'd say to you, well, I didn't think, I've come here for the pill, you see, as if you get this coming, which is very distressing, that there's a complete circle where now the setup is very mechanistic, very sort of efficient, but it's getting divorced from feeling again.
Yes.
And this is what's happening at the clinics, which is very sad. Mm. On the other hand, there's a department for sexual problems, which is separate. You know, it's all departmentalized, like geography, which is a very sad thing. Because this is... Now, but what happened was that in the days when people came to clinics, and they were very busy, the clinics, and the clinics saw mainly the poorer women, because the better off women went, a lot of them went privately in those days, and some of them came to the clinics and so on. In teaching a woman how to use a diaphragm, you had to teach her about her vagina. In this process between doctor and patient, a whole lot of interaction took on, and the way you taught her, the way you made her feel about her body, so it was an awful lot of it, was very often indirect therapy, and was very helpful to a lot of women about accepting their sexuality, where you, if you could be in the role of a permissive, good person to them, who gave them the sort of step into sexuality. You sometimes did a lot of very good work. You also got to know very well, if you were the sort of person, what kind of difficulties she had, and sometimes you were able to help. Well, a whole lot of us who were not like someone whom I was, did feel that more and more that this whole work involved understanding of people's sexuality, of how they felt about their bodies, about the unspoken language of the body, which is very important, what you call nonverbal communication. And we started doing work with helping people with sexual problems, you see, but we all felt at that time that we hadn't had a proper training, you see. And we did set up, and Mrs. Rayfield could have told you a lot about this because she was involved.
Oh, this is the psychosexual side of the
FCA. So a lot of us did an extra, very long training to try and become more aware of this. And this was a group of us who are all now doing different things. And now that it's become a regular thing, the doctors who do family planning can do the training, which is an excellent thing. And it is all in the direction of getting people to be more, the doctors to be more aware of a person, not a vagina. They used to say, a good gynecologist, you asked him what was the color of his patient's eyes, he couldn't tell you, but he could tell you what a cervix looked like. You see, but of course, there is a circle now that the technicians are coming in more and more. Mm. And everything you see, in the times of the Family Planning Association, the clinics were run in a very personal way. There would be a committee of lay people. And these consisted of usually local women, well-to-do, comparatively well-to-do, who had a social conscience, but even more than that, they wanted to be involved in something. If you look at the marriage guidance movement, you'll see the same thing happening. It's terribly interesting to me historically how all these movements start as amateur efforts at an occupation that will be satisfying, that will help one's social conscience, whatever it is, and then gradually they build up into professionalism and specialization and become taken over. This has happened in the family planning. I'm sorry, I'm jumping back.
No, this is, you're saying all sorts of very interesting things, actually.
Now, these groups, as one who has suffered at their hands and gained from their hands, they would set up a committee, and then they would employ the doctors. The committee would make rules for how the clinic was to be run, what fees they would charge. They were always on a part-time basis. They would hire a hall, they would have premises in a hospital, maternity and child welfare clinics, whatever. We were employed by the committee. Now, the committee were partly idealistic women with their idea of giving this marvelous thing to these poor women, without the professional experience of actually dealing with people, which is what we had. They also often felt that they knew much more than the doctors, but unfortunately they had to use the doctors. And some of them were in very much unconscious rivalry with us and liked to have us there, you see? Mm. You were out if you disagreed with them. Mm. And a lot of the doctors, on the other hand, now what was the field? Where did they get their doctors from? Mostly married, young married women with children who couldn't do full-time work, who were very pleased to have their clinic, but were often very timid and didn't feel even terribly professional because they weren't really working like other doctors full-time and so on. And so that they were a group of women who could, in a sense, be more tyrannized, more anxious. You were always trying to...
Were you exploited, perhaps?
Well, they didn't think they were exploiting us, but, for instance, to talk about the revered person, the clinic at North Kensington, where she was the queen, I think you better take this off.
Yes, okay, yes, I mean.
One of the things that emerged in these committees, and I know this very well, power politics. It all started off in all innocence about giving yourself and doing this work. And incidentally, a lot of them were terribly unreliable. There would be a crisis. There would be the volunteer worker who would interview the women, and they wouldn't turn up. Or they'd come half an hour late, and the doctor would be sitting and waiting because there were no patients through. So again, you see, there were all those sort of troubles. But there were a number of them who were very dedicated and took it very seriously and so on. But they were usually women who were in some way or other also playing the power game. And invariably this happened in all committees, all these committees, over and over again, that there would be some kind of disagreement, row, and somebody would resign, always. Well, they'd be out, and then somebody else would be in charge. And this would fluctuate and change, and we were the doctors at the other end. Now, in their idealism, they felt nobody should ever be turned away. If 50 patients came, you should see 50 patients. You should not think of anything else. So again, there would be that you would say, but if you're to do your work properly, you can only see a number of patients. And they would say, well, if you didn't make these difficulties, we wouldn't have to turn these poor women away and so on. I've been in very acrimonious situations in the past.
I can see the problem. Yes.
You see? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we started making our own committees and for instance, at the centre where I worked for many years, but I only retired from there 2 weeks ago, which is now under the DHSS, we had a very active doctor committee because a lot of doctors were employed, and a very active, Mr. Eiffel was on that committee, of very highly intelligent, powerful women. And we had lots of joint meetings. We fought to attend all their meetings, to have our agenda and so on. And we made various agreements, such as that there would be only so many new patients, so many of this and so on. But then this all got swept under the carpet after a time as new people took over, new authorities, and it all started from scratch. Now it's all completely wiped out because now it's all under the DHSS.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The DHSS is worried about, you know, they're hard up. If a clinic hasn't got more than a certain number of patients, it's wiped out. Just as simple as that.
Yes. Yeah, so
and it's all done in a very sort of, you know,
routinized work.
So it depends. Lots of doctors who do this work do it, you know, routinely.
Mm.
They're adequate. But all the things that matter, in a sense, can be very easily left out when it's a pill or when it's a coil, which you just have a woman, you put the coil in and that's it.
Mm.
You treat her nicely because she's nervous or whatever. Mm. But that kind of closeness that you had in those days has gone. There's some of the doctors, again, you see, there are lots of different doctors who feel about this, who go and do this training for special sexual difficulties more, becomes more aware, they're more sensitive, there's an awful lot of work going on about the nonverbal communication, which is so important to pick up and so on. But again, you're all the time, it's all very well to say all this, but when you have to see, say, 20 patients in 2 hours, then you get damn tired too.
Yes.
You know, it's very tempting when a person comes and says to you, please doctor, I want a change of pill because I feel depressed on this one, is to give her another pill.
Yes, without asking why she's depressed.
Well, I mean, this sort of thing,
yes.
which is my way of doing things, and some of us, but on the whole, it tends to be done by trial and error, much more without
I know you said in your letter that your own story was a personal one, rather peculiar, but it is a way into the
But it's not only my story, it's a story of quite a few of us.
Yes, well, as you say, I mean, could you just tell me how you ever got involved in the first place? I mean, how did it happen, exactly?
That I started to family planning?
Yes, I mean, how did it arise? And when?
Oh, well, it was about 1933 or sometime like that, I should think. Can't remember exactly, but...
Round about the mid-30s, anyway.
I knew, actually, there used to be a little private clinic in Shepherd's Bush Road, in general practice round there. I went there for advice for myself, met the doctor who was there, who was a very nice woman, got rather interested. I went to hear a lecture by... The one we've been talking about.
Oh, yes, yes.
Helena Wright.
Yes.
On the Gravenberg Ring, which was a sort of phase that went through. And I was doing baby clinics and I was doing family planning.
As a qualified doctor of a GP type.
Yes, and then I did some training. I went actually and trained under her at her famous, that's how I know so much about that centre.
At North Kensington.
Which was, my way of thinking at that time, was pretty awful because there were hundreds of patients, there was no privacy, little wooden partitions where everybody
could see. Could you describe that actually, how it worked in North Kensington? I mean, what was there?
It was the same setup everywhere, but the actual physical arrangements were different. The centre where I worked for many years was known as the Cecil Boyson Clinic originally. It was founded by Cecil Boyson and Joan Mallison. Did you ever hear of Joan
Mallison?
Now, by the way, if you talk about family planning, the person you should plug is Joan Mallison, because Joan Mallison was one of the first people who was aware of women as human beings who needed understanding, and she was, many years ago, helping people with sexual problems and menopausal women, and at that time she was the only one who really had this approach, and I had the inestimable privilege of working for her and learning from her. And in fact, I came to live in this terrace because she used to live at number 12, because I came in as a sort of... Cecil Boyson had died and I took over part of her practice. So I had the benefit of this, at that time, rather unique person. Was very working as a contemporary of, much younger than Helena Wright, but a contemporary in this field, but with a very different approach, very concerned with the caring of a woman in every way, without any doctrinaire approach.
And was, sorry to interrupt you, but I need to be taught the A to Z anyway. Was this paying patients of a middle-class type, middle or upper-class type, that this...
Well, she also did for many years a clinic at UCH under that famous man who died, Professor Nixon. He invited her to come and work there. And she ran a clinic which was mainly connected with sexual problems and difficulties. Mm. And she had started this clinic that I worked at, which was called the Cecil Boyson. She and Cecil Boyson, who were partners, had opened this clinic.
Just in this row here?
No. It was near the Angel. They had a little house for many years, and then we moved from there. Then we were absorbed by the Borough of Islington, and now the DHSS. But they founded that clinic. And they were both... Cecil Boyson was the same sort of person, but she died of cancer before the war. She was quite young. Joan Mallison was very active at the centre,
as well as having private...
Yes, she didn't actually work there, but she was very active in all the councils and so on. And she was a person whom people like Mrs. Raphael and all that committee would listen to, where they wouldn't listen to us. Because she had started this work much earlier than we had, and she was much respected by these people.
Yes, why? Just because she'd started earlier, or because she had...
Because she was
manner.
Such a person, because she took much more trouble. She had much more insight, much more caring. And therefore, you know, people who went to her as patients, I dare say all that lot had been her patients at some time, knew that she'd given them something very special, and therefore they respected her and listened to her.
Yes, I see.
Now, at North Kensington Clinic, the presiding deaness was Helena Wright and Marjorie Spring Rice, who was a very powerful woman. And again, all this power politics with this group of women, and you know, who would go on being boss? But there, for instance, they would think that, well, Helena Wright would say, it's perfectly all right, of course you can see 30 patients. And whenever we would say at our clinic, we can't see 30 patients, 30 is a minor number, it would be 40, yeah. Because we can't do the work the way it should be done, we would always be told, oh, but Dr. Helena Wright says it's perfectly all right.
And she could do that, presumably, or somebody like her could do it, because they didn't have the more personal attitude to the whole interview process.
Well, it wouldn't be quite fair to her, because she was also personal in her own way. Mm. But you see, in those early days, the work was done differently. For instance, I can remember when we passed a vote that every woman who came to the clinic should have her cervix examined, you know, with a speculum. Do you know these? Do
yes.
You know this? Before that, one didn't do it. We went through a lot of investigation. All that you had was a bowl of disinfectant. I think it was Dettol or one of those things. And you wore the same pair of rubber gloves. And you just scrubbed up in that and went from patient to patient. And in some way, I can remember that one of our group who was good at pathology took a whole lot of tests out and discovered that the two curses of minor curses in women's life, that is thrush, and trichomonas, I don't know how much you're familiar with these things, were there as a sort of cause a lot of irritation and so on, and are very infected. That they just sat and laughed in some dish of Dettol, and it was at that point that we made a whole lot of rules that you had to change a glove between each patient, that it, you know, that you had to do speculums. I mean, all this, of course, you could work a lot faster when you just dipped your hands into a little bit longer.
Yes,
and also when you've got your patients lined up in cubicles and you go from one cubicle to the next and they'll do this and then the nurse takes over. Mm. You see? I mean, when you think that the work was done one cubicle after another, I think that the doctor saw them. I don't know whether she ever saw them in a separate room. What we set up in our place was a private room where the doctor saw the patients and had a private conversation.
When you say our place, do you mean
the Islington one?
The Islington one, yes. Mm.
But there, you know, you can work ever so much faster, as they do in hospitals when the consultant goes round, you know.
They're all in cubicles.
Yes, and everybody can hear everything.
Was that how it worked in Kensington then?
What?
North Kensington at the time. Was that how it worked in North Kensington?
Yes, that's had a number of cubicles.
Mm. And the doctor went from
yes, I think they may have had a little interview where they saw them first.
Yes, I think.
But what I remember that when I went to train them, when I used to sometimes do locums, that I always thought it was awful. And then the sister took them to teach them in a little tiny corner where they all squatted, which I think is awful, and so on. And she had a particular sister who was rather powerful. Well, anyway, that's all. It's easy to criticize it now, but that is the way. And they were done in church halls and all sorts of very inadequate places where there was very little privacy. And there was a great deal of movement, the doctors more and more that there should be, that it wasn't enough to give people advice, but you had to give it in a certain way, you had to respect the woman. And also that, I remember that at one phase, they had enormous numbers of people always. But what you really had to look at was not that, but how many people returned and returned again. And you found that there was a great deal of dropping on the way.
Yes, so your objective was to get returns, treating them better and so on.
Well, you know, that you felt that if you gave people what they wanted, they were more likely to come back than if you just gave them, or some of them stayed and so on.
Mm.
But it's awfully hard to put all this into simple
words.
Then you see what happened was that as time went on, the voluntary people also became those of them who were really concerned and so on, felt that they were inadequate, and they started having training courses for them, how to interview people and all the rest of it, and they approached much more the professional.
Mm.
And some of them,
so
in
fact, professionalisation from both ends, really,
yes,
both the interviewing
and of course, as time has gone on, a lot of the doctors who do family planning clinics now are not doing it just as a part-time job at all. They're either part of the National Health Service or general practitioners in the area being drawn in more and more, so they do it part, or they have their own clinics now for birth control in their own practice.
So are you getting sort of birth control doctors in a way now? I mean, specialising to that extent?
Well, you see, you have to do a special training.
Mm.
And yet again, you see, we were on the other summer, was developed a lot of extra skill because we were specialising in I mean, I came to live in this house because of Joan Maddison, and I have always had a private practice, which of course gives me a much wider spectrum. And I've always worked at clinics, so.
But would a working class woman come to your surgery here?
No, because you have to pay fees to come to a private. No, that's now it's become ever so much localized. It became, you see, then there was a law, wasn't there? There was a new ruling that maternity and child welfare clinics should provide family planning services. Actually, I was one of the few people who worked as well in a maternity and child welfare centre as a family planning doctor. That was what became the Borough of Camden afterwards, for many years. And it was Joan Maddison who opened that clinic. They ran a small clinic. And there were a number of these in England, because I did one in Harrow for a time. That was before the war, where family planning was available to the mothers who attended their, you know, their babies on, it always had to be on a health ground. You could only give it to people who had a health reason, but of course, depended on the doctor. I never turned anybody away, you see, but it a lot of clinics, they couldn't see people before they'd had intercourse or before they were married or whatever. Mm. It depended on your interpretation.
Yeah.
Now, there was such a centre, which is where I've worked until 2 weeks ago, for many years, where it's a maternity and child welfare centre. It's called the Province of Natal, which is part of the Institute of Child Health now. And we ran the service for all those women who were medically entitled to family planning. In other words, they were supposed to be the women who just had a baby, anyone who just had a baby. But in fact, I don't think I ever refused anybody, because one could always find a reason. Then there came out this directive that maternity and child welfare clinics must provide a contraceptive service.
So we were taking health, that is.
Yes, that's right. I can't tell you which year it was, but you probably know those things. And so that particular clinic became then one of the Camden welfare services provided. It just went on as it had done. But lots and lots, all the maternity and child welfare centres opened clinics, and they trained their health visitors very often to be the nurses, and they took doctors who were doing maternity and child welfare work and asked them to do family planning training, which wasn't altogether quite as good as it sounds, because lots of those doctors really didn't like family planning work, and a lot of the health visitors, and I've trained quite a few of them, really didn't, weren't keen on it, but they were asked, they were sent to do the training, you see. And so again, the whole thing has become as part of one of the aspects of the maternity and child family health. That clinic now is called the Family Health Clinic. And it's now under the DHSS, where it's all being streamlined, like all the others, according geographically.
Yes.
And it will be, they have meetings, medical meetings, and so on, discuss policy and so on within this. But it's all very streamlined.
One of the interesting things about this movement seems to me is it's not frightened of government at all. What it's trying to do is to get government involved all the time and to get the government to take over its own activities.
Well, what the family planning always said, that the time would come when family planning would be absolutely expected and would be taken over by the government or the National Health Service or whatever, and that has come about, and they've all given up now. But it's also a great loss in many ways, because all the individuality, all the sort of passionate feeling has gone out of it. And with the coming of the pill and the IUD, it allows it to be a much more...
So mechanistic, really.
And if you work at clinics, as I do, and you see the sort of ever so many things that are absolutely missed, and people are lost and so on, and, you know, directing people to a special clinic for sexual difficulties is quite a complex thing, and you've already got to already perceive things and so on, and it isn't always the patient who asks or even knows they can ask. And so, where there was a more intimate contact of the old kind of clinic, it was somehow
But then again, you see,
things are always changing, because with the specialization, there's always two movements in medicine, the mechanistic, the one that's going to save your life by technical means, but truly, but isn't so good about everyday living. And yes. The other kind is involved with everyday living, and the total, what we call total medicine, you know, like we have a psychosomatic society for psychosomatic research, where people are constantly discussing all the aspects of this training for understanding better about sexual difficulties, which is really part of life, you know, rather than
a technical.
On the other hand, there's this very obvious movement about sexual information. Sex has come on the map in a very mechanistic way. So when you work with sexual difficulties, you're up against this mechanistic conception of your patients who come and say to you, I don't want to talk about myself, you just tell me how to get my orgasm, or to the men, how to keep my erection longer. I'm not going to talk to you. Where you're stuck with this very mechanistic approach, understand? And this is two ways that medicine is going at the moment. With the economies and the trying to make it much more, it's a civil service administrative thing now, there are many more clerks and all the rest of it, and forms to sign and so on.
But another of the interesting things about this movement does seem to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that you're always learning from your patients.
Of course.
It's growing and growing and growing all the time.
And the culture is changing all the time.
Yes.
Every decade.
Yes. I mean, you start off just being concerned to limit size of families, and then you start...
You never start like that. You simply are there available to give people birth control.
Yes.
Now, you're talking about trying to limit families. I don't know... I mean, I'm not in politics. Now, one of the awful things that's happened, for instance, to my way of thinking, is that at any cost, a family must be limited, right? So what happens? When the people are training to do family planning, one of the things they get taught is that sterilization and vasectomy is a very good method. Okay, it may be for some people, but it should be from their own choice. But what happens, and I've had this repeated to me by a number of patients who have been distressed, others have not repeated it because they've not been distressed, and they've gone to the local clinic, and the doctors looked up to them brightly and said, well, you've got two children, your family is complete, now why don't you get yourself sterilized? To a woman in her 20s or early 30s.
Yes, that was one of my points, actually. You see,
well, I think it's dreadful, you see.
It starts off as family limitation, but immediately you suddenly realize that you're also involved in actually giving people the size of family they want.
Well, but I am very, very much against, and I feel it's terrible. And when I train doctors, this is one of the things I discuss, but we had 4 years ago, a super duper course at family planning for training doctors. Which was very interesting. Some of us made a great fuss about it. This sterilization of us acting was being pushed.
But then another area where you spread out is into gynecology, isn't it, really? And the whole question
of... You shouldn't be doing family planning if you're... You can't... Well, when you're training people, by the way, one of the things you have to... First, one of the things you have to decide, is a gynae good enough?
Yes.
And you turn people down straight away, because people turn up whose gynae is lamentable, and you say, well, this is not to teach you how to do your gynae. You go and get some training and come back, or you can't. You see, this is one of
but
the
it's
things.
Sort of spontaneously growing, in a sense, isn't it, in its range of interest?
Well, that's always been there, that anyone who's done this work had to be skillful gynecologically. I mean, or they shouldn't be doing
it.
I mean, the way you examine a patient to begin with, and it's one of the things I've taught a lot about. You get an anxious woman on a couch, she's frightened, and you're going to... You know, you've got to get her to relax. Well, you don't tell her, incidentally, one of the things I always train people is you don't say to a patient, relax, because she would reply, I would if I could, doctor.
Yes,
I have all kinds of tricks.
Yes.
But I don't tell them to relax.
Yes, of course. But, so you, in a sense, like quite a lot of people who are involved in the birth control movement, you don't come in specifically for feminist reasons at all, is that right?
No, I'm much more concerned with people finding their own identity, which is not necessarily women. I mean, I'm not politically a fighter for women's living in an aggressive way as rights against men. I think the important thing about the sexual relationship is that two people can communicate.
Yes. So
and certainly if one is going to be victimized and feels angry, but then lots of women feel very angry for all sorts of reasons which are not really the fault of the men.
But if you're trying to explain the relationship between the birth control movement and the feminist movement in this country, they're tangential, they're not the same movement.
They're not the same movement at all, and it didn't arise out of that.
No.
But of course it's being used, you see, politically by all kinds of groups of women, who are very often having their own thing that they are fighting about. But I mean, I don't particularly think about the exploitation of women or men. No. I know lots of relationships where the man is being exploited and so on.
Yes.
I know lots of very angry women who swallow the pill because they feel it's terribly unfair that they should swallow the pill to be set subjects for their men.
Yes, yes.
On the other hand, I know women who will only have the pill because it feels it puts them on an equal basis with men, and they can say, damn you, I shall take my pleasure and you can go. You know, it can be used and misused.
But on the other hand, couldn't you argue the other way and say that although your initial motivation wasn't feminist in a crude sense, nonetheless, you get acquainted with the problems and difficulties and
of
women much more as a result of being involved.
Of course, you learn in a very, very wide way about different attitudes, different fantasies.
So, but in a way, does it make you? Did you find it made you more feminist as you experienced more and more?
No, because you're talking such a very narrow way. You're a historian with no concept, it seems to me, about the meaning of human relationships, about people's search for their own identity, people's wishing to be what they, you know, to fulfill what they could be. Which is something quite different. And you're talking in such a terribly narrow way. Of course I see a girl who'll go and get herself pregnant. Because I remember some years ago an instance, this girl was brought to me. She'd got her A-levels, not very good ones, and had been turned down ever so many universities. What does she do? She gets herself pregnant, she's going to marry the boy. Fine. I mean, how many women have escaped into their physiology and so on? I think that's very sad, but then people mature in different ways. Sometimes they have to do it the hard way through a lot of breakages and so on. And I'm much more concerned with that and with my patients and establishing something honest about what their motives are. Like the woman I've been seeing who has a lot of problems and a very difficult marriage, who has always complained about her husband, who is a very passive, difficult man. Now, she's finally, because of her discontent, and very resistant, the husband, to any help. And she's a very angry woman, which has nothing to do with him, although it's always his fault. Finally, at last, he has been willing to go and get some help. So, at a recent interview, she tells me, quite sweetly, that although whenever she's asked him what has transpired between him and the doctor he goes to see, he's become angry. She tells me this as a grievance, that he'd been to see this man, and she said to him, because I was feeling loving, she said, what did you talk about? And of course, they had a row. And she's very hurt that he won't tell her. And I say to her, well, I wonder what really made you ask him, because I know she's extremely jealous and controlling and she can't really bear. And moreover, that he's going to the doctor whom she used to go and see, who referred her to me, you see. So that there, in trying to help her, what I'm concerned is that she should not pull the wool over her own eyes. So often for instance, there's the girls who come and tell you how victimized they've been by men. Over and over again you hear the story, one after the other. And you see, whenever you prick up your ears, this is a sort of victim par excellence. What's it all about? Where's the aggression and why has she got to be a victim? And so on and so forth. So you see, you're not really concerned with one political system or another. You are trying to enable each person to have the potential. So many women have so many hangs up about their bodies. One of the reasons, I suppose, is that in a woman everything is hidden, and therefore they can be so out of touch. They can have fantasy, but the reality of their bodies they're out of touch with. And that you spend a lot of time trying to put them in touch with their own bodies so they can feel more that they belong to them, it's part of them, they can use it and so on. This is quite a different kind of skilled job I'm talking a language which you're not familiar with.
No, but you're illuminating a lot of things.
So you see, how should I become more of a feminist or less of a feminist? I will tell you that I was very fortunate in having a father who was a distinguished scientist, who believed always, I mean from the time I was born actually, they decided I was going to be a doctor, which I had to go through my own rebellions about and so on. But in our family, if I came home with a bad mark from college, I was as much in trouble as my brothers. And he certainly believed that it was important for me to get a profession and an education and so on. And so I never particularly, the only time I suffered from my feminist rebellions was when it came to the washing up. My mother, when it was my brother's turn, my mother would creep in and say, "Well, I'll do it." And when it was my turn, I did it, and I used to. And so they used to call me in those days the feminist, you see, at home, yes. Because yes. I felt it was so unfair. Mm. And I dare say that brushed off in my own son.
You're not having your coffee, that slightly worries me.
Well, I had in those days, one was always looking for work, and there was a vacancy, and I started working there.
You were working under Dr. Madison here first.
I don't know which way around it was, but I met Dr. Madison before 1939.
Mm.
And started to work for her then, part-time capacity. Then Cecil, that was just after Cecil Boysen had died, and she said that if I would work for her, I bought part of Cecil Boysen's practice, she sent me patients, and this house became vacant. At the time we needed to move, so I came here.
Mm.
And then she sent me work, which started my private practice.
So it's not that working class women come to your private practice and you can't.
Well, some of them do, because they prefer to pay me a fee. You see, as a result of all the streamlined system is that lots of women do feel they want to talk to somebody personally, privately. And they, of course, then they go in the private sector. I mean, private practice flourishes on the defects of the national health practice. It, of course, my practice has altered its character in them. Earlier days, that was mainly birth control, and a lot of unmarried women, of course, a lot of clinics would refuse to see. And I've never had any, I've never felt that a woman has got to wait till she's married and so on.
No.
So I always had a large practice. Now, most of those people now get it free on the National Health, and they don't want to spend the money going to see privately, except the better-to-do women on the whole, who still prefer to come privately. Or those women who have a problem about something or other and they want to buy privacy and time.
Yes.
Or, what was the other group I was thinking of? Or people with sexual problems, because to get adequate advice on sexual problems on the National Health, despite its window dressing, is really very difficult.
Yes.
So now I'm known amongst, not lot of doctors who know me and they've got such a problem, they'll often refer them to me.
Yes, I understand.
And the marriage, I've also worked with the marriage guidance people who refer a number of people where they feel that there's more question of physical, sexual, rather than a marital, See, people choose which agency they go to.
Mm.
And so, but so that my private practice has altered its character quite a lot.
Yes,
it's much harder work than it used to be, because I very rarely get anyone straightforward.
Yes, yes.
Now this morning I saw a girl who had had a rather disastrous pregnancy. The baby died at 3 months, so I've gathered, because the story had been put together. Was very well treated at the hospital. I mean, she lost this baby, but she was completely confused about what really happened, and although everybody was very nice to her and went to a great deal of trouble in the investigation, she was told a slightly distorted story, I think, to spare her the fact. I think the baby had died in utero about 10 weeks, and they found it out by scanning, but they didn't like to tell her that she had a dead baby there. What they told her was that she'd lost the baby, but they gave her a curettage. It doesn't make sense to you, but anyway, the point is that she wanted to talk to somebody.
Mm.
And she
was
a friend of hers. So she came and sat an hour and a half here talking about all the possibilities and so on.
Mm.
And it was very important to her. But she said, if I go to the hospital, of course I haven't got the time.
Mm.
So that's only explaining how private practice works now. But
what did you actually do in these clinics, like the Goswell Road Clinic? I mean, did you go there personally yourself, or did they send people to you
they never
how
sent,
work?
Oh, no, they never sent you private work.
Mm.
No, I went there, I did so many sessions a week.
And what did you actually do when you got there? You sat in a room, presumably, and saw the people when they were fed to you by the interviewers.
Well, they would arrive at the clinic, they would be interviewed by a lay worker. They would, in the early days, have to pay a fee. We used to have all kinds of different arrangements, and then they would come into the clinic room, and they would go into the doctor's room and be interviewed there, where they would listen. We had cards, you know, history taking
cards.
That's
right, yes, Mrs. Raffles
and that. And one, but not that one always. I mean, the old cards used to ask you how many times a week you had intercourse. But
presumably you modify these cards with experience all the time.
We were trying to, but also we didn't, when before they were modified, necessarily ask the questions we were supposed to ask, because one has to always work as a doctor, not necessarily agree with all the, maybe very interesting statistically to know how many times a week women have intercourse by and large, but it may not be a question that your patient would appreciate.
No.
So on and so forth. You know, every patient's different, as I often said when I've lectured, that when a patient